And I definitely side on more of the side of not wanting to be formal and fussy like that. And I think it comes a couple of different reasons. One is I agree all that kind of formal stuff is just stuffy and not that much fun. And two, if you're focused on your cocktails so much and doing a really great job on cocktails, you kind of want your food to take care of itself a little bit.
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat, and in the case of this week's episode, drink, and also read. I am your co-host, Matt Miller, culture editor at onmilwaukee.com, and I'm joined, as always, by dining editor at onmilwaukee.com, Lori Frederick. How are you doing today, Lori?
I'm doing pretty well. It's cold, but sunny.
Yeah, it's officially winter in Wisconsin.
We've gone over the threshold.
Yeah, we've gotten some vague snow flurries. It's stupid cold outside.
We're supposed to get an inch of snow over the next 2 days.
I refuse to accept this information.
It's almost the holidays. So
but yeah, and you know what? You know what's great? When the weather's cold outside, some soul-warming beverages.
Yes.
With and without alcohol. And we're here to talk to somebody who knows something about that. Lori, would you like to talk with our guest? Or introduce our guest?
Would you like to talk with them? And then we'll proceed.
Yeah, this would be a very bad podcast if you did not want to talk with him.
But we are here with Andre Darlington, a longtime writer, author of a brand new book called Bar Menu. And we will talk more about that, but this is Andre's eighth cocktail book, which means he's been really, really busy for probably the past 5 years, Andre?
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. It's been since 2016 is when the first one came out, so it's been a wild ride.
Okay. Oh, so 8 years. So you got about a book a year, which...
Yeah. That's too much. Yep.
Yeah, having just finished my second, a book a year is, you know.
But now you get to call this your magnum opus, though, because this one took so much time. This one took so much time to percolate.
It's true. And it kind of is. So the rest are all pretty heavy cocktail books with a little bit of food in them. And this one's all food. So this is definitely a book I've been working toward for a long time because I started out as a food writer. Went and became a wine writer, did a cocktail column, and then the cocktail books have become the thing. So I was really excited to sort of be able to use my food world stuff.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your background because, I mean, I met you because you spent quite a significant amount of time in Madison.
Yeah.
But kind of how you got there and ended up doing food writing there.
A good long time in Madison. I was there. I actually went to college, Bullitt College in Wisconsin there. And Madison was like the cool city just north. So after college, I moved up there. Actually had quite a long career in IT before I ever started writing. I started writing on the side. And that side job eventually became...
And it paid so much better.
It paid so well. You know, I felt like I got into it right when everybody was telling me to get out of it. You know, sort of the entire industry was collapsing. These were the Craigslist years that wiped out all of the wanted ads, you know, that were the bread and butter of a lot of these regional newspapers or newspapers everywhere, honestly. Yeah. So the internet was kind of... destroying the industry. And I think I got my first writing gigs because I stayed up later than everybody else on staff. So I would get these sort of late night food eats articles, kind of whatever they threw my way. I'd be like, sure, I'll do that. That'll be fun. And then as the inevitable happens, if you hand in work on time and you hand in clean copy and, you know, if it's good work, eventually somebody moves on or somebody can't do something and you just get more and more assignments. And that turned into pretty much being the regular restaurant reviewer for Madison after there was a guy named Raphael Kudishin before me, who is a very well-known restaurant reviewer there. He went on to write for Food and Wine. And then I sort of stepped up to the plate after a couple of years there, sort of cutting my teeth, learning the industry. And then... I actually got I was writing wine articles, and my editor there said, oh, I'm going to send in your articles and see if we can get you to be a Napa Valley Vintner Association fellow. And I sort of laughed. I hadn't been doing it that long. I didn't think my work was particularly great. But lo and behold, a couple of months later, I won a fellowship to Napa Valley, the Writer Symposium there, where you're like paired with a... a mentor and all kinds of crazy stuff happens for you. So I decided that I was just young enough to still do something really dumb, like quit my day job.
Right.
So that was probably 2012, 2013. I quit my day job. And strangely enough, ended up with a book deal fairly soon afterwards. And then also ended up with a restaurant fairly soon afterwards. Yeah. I opened a restaurant.
You don't just end up with restaurants, but yeah.
Yeah. It was funny. As a restaurant writer in that market, I was sort of, you know, unofficially helping, sort of developments, right. There are all these condo buildings going up, and the developers would come to me and they would say, hey, do you know anybody kind of looking, you know, restaurateurs are always looking for good space, and people that have space are always looking for somebody to fill it.
And people connected to the restaurateurs are always getting asked, do you know anybody who should go in here?
Exactly. So basically that got started because one of the developers was like, no, I want you to do something in here. And I had never really thought of doing it, but it was sort of my chance to do it. And so anyway, I had a restaurant. So, and then the cocktail books just against all odds started taking off. And I ended up moving to New York and then Philadelphia. So I was in Philadelphia for the last 5 years. I just moved to North Carolina in the last few months. So my major press was in Philadelphia. And of course, a lot of media runs out of New York. So it was
you started off your cheese expert sister. Lives in Philly as well.
Yeah, the first three books were with Tanaya. She's back working on cheese. She spent the year in Europe. So started doing solo projects, and here I am. I actually just signed for my 12th book. So I have books going out till 2025. It's been just a wild ride. The books were doing well anyway, and then the pandemic, everything just went nuclear. People staying at home.
So many people making
cocktails.
Absolutely. Well, and your transition, like from food to wine to cocktails, that does not seem strange at all to me. I mean, especially to the cocktail piece, because cocktails essentially are building balance flavor profiles, which is exactly what food does. I always tell people, like, I feel, you know, if there's a place in the beverage world that I understand, it's definitely cocktails, because it's
because you have a food background as well.
To food,
I tell people, I mean, it's silly, but it is essentially cold alcoholic soup.
Or warm, you know, depending on which direction you're heading.
Exactly. It's soup that then you dilute with ice. But all those flavor blocks are there, you know. So and texture and everything. So it's super interesting. Yeah, I mean, I would love to be. I still love wine writing. I still love the wine world. I'm not in it as much anymore after doing so much cocktail work, but. You know, basically my publisher was like, we love your voice, but wine writing doesn't sell. Would you like to write about cocktails? And that was back in 2016. And you know, what was funny is back in 2016, I sort of told the publisher, you know, like, I think we're sort of at the end of this whole cocktail craziness. And I couldn't have been more wrong, right? Because I never foresaw that cocktails would be, you know, basically at Applebee's, you know, and you walk into any restaurant and they have, you know, quote unquote, craft cocktails. So it was just the explosion was unbelievable.
Now, like you said, a lot of your books have focused really on cocktails and cocktail recipes and, you know, pretty much like, you know, riffs on classics and and all of that. What inspired this book? Because this book is largely like, I mean, Bar Bites, as it's titled. But really kind of gets us back to that idea of, you know, either happy hour or the cocktail, you know, the cocktail hour at home or cocktail parties at home.
So there's a few strains going on at the same time. One was in 2016 when I wrote that a book called The New Cocktail Hour. It was basically about this brave new craft cocktail movement that really started sort of from 2000 and spread from east to west across the country. And sort of we're going back, you know, to good ice, good ingredients, all that kind of stuff.
And it spared us from all of those terrible
80s drinks
martinis.
That we were in college, we, Yeah. The fuzzy navels and the mind blowers and all those kind of crazy things. Although those are kind of back.
Another I was going to say the retro part of that. Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, you get lemon drops in every book.
When I wrote that book, it was already I had in my mind, wow, things have changed in the cocktail hour, but food has also changed. The cocktail kitchen has really changed. So if I look up on my shelf, I have a number of appetizers books that supposedly go with cocktails. It's all blend. You're supposed to make 20 food items, right? For a cocktail hour, you're supposed to make 20 items. They're all bland. It's always something like extruded onto a cracker, it's like a canapé with caviar. Right. It's fussy. If you have anything that has any flavor at all, it would be, you know, not Mexican, but Mexican inspired. And that crossed with my wine writing, where I have a ton of books on the wall that are actually very good that tell you what to pair with what, you know, grape varietal. And then in 2019, I circumnavigated the globe right before the pandemic to write that book, Booze Cruise.
Booze Cruise.
Yeah. And I just ran into all these cultures around the world that had caught the craft cocktail, fever. And they were bringing in all sorts of exciting things from their culture to be the bar snacks. And sort of all those three things. One was, gosh, we really need to upgrade our... there is kind of no cocktail food book specifically. You can buy appetizer sort of party books, but nothing that goes from cocktail to food. It's all like, here's a great little, Martha Stewart makes wonderful appetizers books. They're great books. They're different. And cocktails are sort of like, you know, an aside, or you almost even have to get a separate book, right? Or you have to know what you're doing there. But there's still kind of old school appetizers.
For so many years, people didn't really believe, and I think this is where the blandness of the appetizer thing comes from. People didn't really believe that cocktails could be paired,
For sure.
Well. With
for sure. There was definitely a bias against cocktails that for you, absolutely, if you were going to have a fancy wine dinner, you know, that was coursed with like burgundy, you would never begin that dinner with a cocktail because it would blow your palate, right?
Right.
And things have changed so much that people, you think nothing of having a Negroni before dinner and then going to a nice Italian wine. You know, we just don't kind of believe that. You know, after you don't want to drink it right away, but after 5-10 minutes of eating something, your palate's sort of reset.
Exactly. In fact, you can ostensibly have a whole meal, multi-course meal paired with cocktails.
Yeah, I just did that. New Orleans.
Nobody's
going to
die.
I know exactly. No one's going to die. And it really is kind of this brave new world of cocktails. That cocktails are ascendant. Mm-hmm. They're no longer sort of de classe or sub wine. And, you know, also the idea that, we can have food, too, that's bold and spicy and not fussy. In fact, these days, I feel like the fussier, the better. If you have a party and, if you have like a taco party and the juices are running down people's arms, that's the party they remember, you know? It's very, things have gotten very informal by comparison, you know, where
and,
it used
and
to be.
And cocktails have, too, in a sense. I mean, we went through the craft cocktail movement, started out with like, bow ties and vests and really kind of
mustaches.
Everything was very spiffy.
Do we even go back further to like the Sex and the City era of like the Cosmos and like the candy cocktails and those kind of?
The bad cocktails that the modern movement got.
The Cosmos is sort of the transitional cocktail between those two worlds, the bad old worlds that sort of I grew up in college. Yeah. And then we have to give credit to the Cosmo for really causing certainly a boom in people going out to restaurants and having a cocktail at all. And then that sort of started the ball rolling, and then Mad Men sort of put us up over the edge where everyone's asking for an old fashioned.
I was going to ask about, how much of the Mad Men influence really is there, because it's wild that it feels like that show really did kind of shift the culture into be like, no, like drinking a sophisticated cocktail or drink.
I have a decanter of bourbon in my office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. There you go. As one does. Yeah. I would expect no less. The Mad Men, the craft cocktail revolution had moved across the United States so that we were having, New York style speakeasies appearing in LA by the mid 2000s. And I think it was But Mad Men was the perfect thing to push it all up over the top, where these bars were there. Craft cocktail aficionados existed and were filling them. And then with Mad Men happening, the general public started coming in too.
Okay. That was the kind of tipping point.
It was perfect tipping point. It all kind of gelled and came together, you know, to the point where you'd see the cast, you know, going into these famous cocktail bars, and all of America was like, geez, I want to go do that. Dress up again and be treated well again.
I want to feel like a sophisticate.
Exactly.
Right.
So it did kind of all happen. And, you know, we're sort of in a world post that where things have kind of gone in all, both directions. There's still some of those kind of fussier places around. But then also craft cocktails just kind of metastasize into the general culture, where we do, you know, sort of every good restaurant is expected to also have a little craft cocktail program.
Absolutely.
Is a good spot to be, because now we have tons of choices. You know, we can basically, you know, walk into a, you know, dirt on the floor mezcalero type bar, or we can still go out fancy, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. You just find something new and different in all of those places.
Do you find that places are still doing new and different stuff, or has it become so saturated that, you know, everywhere kind of does the same few things or something like that? Are you still seeing invention and places pushing the boundaries?
For sure. Pushing the boundaries. Things are still moving. I would agree that there's definitely a large glut of a lot of people doing similar things, in the same way that the mid-2000s, boy, everything's going to be sort of a gastropub, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the Edison lights and the you know, the rough-hewn walls and the farmhouse stuff.
The farm-to-table.
There is a general, you know, there's sort of a general cohort, as, you know, I think, you know, some restaurant owners are actually just investors, and they sort of check all these different boxes of what would you like your restaurant to look like? And they're like, yes, I would like a Negroni, you know. And so there's kind of a general glut there. But I've also just seen it go in a bunch of different directions, and it's still pretty exciting out there. It's fun that it's gone completely mainstream. And then it's fun that within that mainstream, there's some really interesting and exciting stuff happening, whether it's like replacement of citrus in the drinks, whether it's removing the brand from behind the bar, whether it's single, you know, spirit focused, you know, hey, we're a gin bar, or there's a lot of, hey, we're a Mexican distillates bar. So there's some really great stuff. You know, in the mid-2000s, it was just tough to get interesting bottles. And now that we all have all the interesting bottles, what are the choices we get to make within there?
Right. And how can we riff on classics that people love? And I mean, people are turning that on its table, which to me underscores really the formulaic nature, you know, of the cocktail, and the flexibility and, you know, I mean, you abide by a few basic rules. And,
you know, it's sort of infinity within some certain constraints.
Yeah. And a brandy cocktail can suddenly become a mezcal-based cocktail and, you know, changes the whole game.
Yeah, it's true. I do a fair amount of consulting a little bit behind the scenes for restaurant groups and whatnot. And I always remind people that, you know, your favorite restaurant or all of our favorite restaurant isn't really necessarily recreating the wheel. They're just doing what their neighbors are doing, but they're doing it so much better. Right. So I always think that, you know, you can still open a cocktail bar in any city in the United States. And if it serves incredible versions of the classics and it has incredible staff, you're going to win. And I think actually, it's interesting because it's a truism, I think, is especially true in Wisconsin, because we understand that, I think, from the supper clubs. The supper clubs are not recreating anything new, but the good ones give you something special.
Yeah.
And even though it's also a steak.
Keeping something beloved alive.
Yes. Yeah.
And often putting their own twist on it, which makes them memorable. And that's,
absolutely. So I think there's it's sort of infinity within certain constraints or within a look or within a genre, you know, you know, what classic cocktail bars gave us was sort of not just the cocktails back, but sort of a business model, you know, that went along with it, which was these sort of bespoke bartenders serving you really great individual drinks again with interesting creative stuff, history on the menu. You know, it was very, very different from when I came out of college, even when, you know, bars didn't have menus. I constantly remind young people, it's like, right. You know, when I came out of college, they didn't even have menus. You just had to order like what your drunk uncle drank at Thanksgiving, you know,
right.
And pray that you right. also liked it. And then
and
turns out
that
you usually
like, yes,
didn't.
The first cocktail you could pick up that you knew the name
exactly,
of.
Exactly.
Isn't that how people get introduced to alcohols though? Like, I feel like
for
everyone
sure.
gets yeah. introduced to beer and cocktails by like what they've heard or like
for
what
sure.
they've seen on TV. Like, it is such a, okay, yeah. like, all of my first beers were like ones that I saw ads for where I was like,
yeah.
okay, I'll try or, Red yeah. Stripe, you know?
Yeah.
You order a cocktail that you, especially I think cocktails, because it can be really intimidating at
yep.
first as a newbie to like look at all these options and to be like, I don't know what any of this means.
Right.
I don't know yeah. what I am looking at or supposed to be drinking here. So I guess I'll order the thing that I know other people order.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great way to start. I think it's how we all started, you know, with the older brother or sister or some kind of influence, you know, being like, hey, here's Boone's Farm. Try this. You know, it's kind of whatever you can get your hands on. And I think that's really true with cocktails still, too, that people kind of gravitate to. People definitely have an idea of what cocktails are supposed to be. And then they discover which ones they actually like, you
yeah.
know.
Do you think we're getting better at kind of democratization, maybe isn't the right word, but kind of making, because there was, it did feel, especially in that early craft cocktail era, the mixologist era of it,
right.
there was this feeling of like kind of gatekeeping isn't the right word, but this kind of feeling for a lot of people of like, this is for the experts only.
If and you I'm know, not, you know.
I'm, yeah, like, yeah. These cocktails are wasted on my silly, dumb, plebeian palate, you know? but
yeah,
have we gotten better at that?
We have.
Okay.
I think so. It depends on the market, but it's a great question, and I love talking about that because I feel like my career has been specifically to demystify things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I come from a journalism background, because I came from like writing for a weekly, I was always deeply opposed to that kind of... I'm always like, what can kill the cocktail faster than if it just becomes a huge click among people that can get some really select bottles?
Yeah,
right.
And I sort of hate that. And in mm-hmm. my books, I always make sure that I don't have a lot of esoteric ingredients that, you know, the first complaint is, hey, I can't get that.
Yeah. And because also the most frustrating thing about any cookbook,
oh, yeah.
and this includes cocktail books, is to open it up and skim through and go, oh, I'd love to make that, I'd love to make that.
Absolutely.
And then realize that it's some of the ingredients in it that might actually make the drink are
right.
like, super yeah. hard to get wherever
right.
you are.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things have gotten better even in the last 10 years. You know, you can get a lot of stuff on Amazon.
Yeah.
You know,
tons
a lot
on
of
Amazon.
Stuff.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
does
and
feel
even
like,
liquor stores
yeah.
are so much better. But yeah.
Yeah. It does feel a little bit like the craft beer scene kind of struggled a little bit with that kind of vibe of like, no, like all the special beers that come out and stuff like that. And I think that's why there's been such a pushback on maybe the craft beer scene in recent years, because there was this feeling of like, you know, this is a click. This is you're making beers for people, for collectors, basically,
right.
and not for people who want to just drink something. And I think craft beer has figured that out and kind of moved away from doing the kind of, you know,
yeah,
they're finding a better balance, I would
yeah.
say.
Yeah. Well, we have all these people who decided like, oh, let's just brew lager again.
Yeah.
Right. Imagine
people that. Like to drink. Everybody
yeah.
likes to
it's
drink.
It's weird
lager,
that we turned away from the septuple,
you know,
IPAs
cult.
And the,
yeah.
you know.
Well, and now I think we're in a healthier spot where there's the breweries that do all the whackball stuff, you
mm-hmm.
know, and are known for that. And then we have a lot more that are just doing really, really solid
yeah.
versions of.
Yeah,
I
mean, in the heady
drinks.
Days of both those movements, I think there was a sense of, like, it was like in music, you know? You're like,
mm-hmm.
oh, I listened to that band before they were big. You know,
oh,
it was like,
yeah.
oh,
yeah.
I drank Chartreuse 3 years ago. It's so over.
Yeah.
You know?
Classic,
and
the classic mid-aught lines of, like, oh, they were better before they went big. You
exactly.
know?
That's exactly the attitude in both cocktails and in craft
yes.
beer. And I think
I
hopefully
have an
we're past that.
I drip in my dining room.
yeah. It's...
You know,
it's just
yeah.
always it's always wild to me. This is a true story. I rendered someone speechless by telling them that I did not particularly like Eagle Park's beers. And I mean, yeah. literally 2 minutes of silence. Like, the woman could not summon words to explain.
because they came through the gate with, like, they were doing milkshake IPAs.
They are fingers on the pulse of what is happening. Yeah. Like, what is the hottest thing in New York craft brew scene?
And now, interestingly enough, they're going to be the keepers of the recipes for Milwaukee Brewing Company.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Which I would not describe as like a eclectic, you know, beer taste. Like that's right. I wouldn't call that like a beer connoisseur's lineup of beers. Like that's, I don't mean that in a bad way. Mm-hmm. I just mean that in like, I find a lot of their beers just very drinkable. And like, that is kind of like, there's a reason why they blew up as kind of Milwaukee's earliest, one of their early craft brewery places is because they made pretty classic stuff. I don't think they made a lot of adventurous stuff.
Well, they did. I mean, because they infused tea. A lot of their popular inaugural things were a little bit experimental at the time because they were infusing teas and things into their beer. Just that it was still exceedingly delicious, and they were, you know, so it made them a little bit different, but also really
easy to drink.
How dare they?
How are you going to get hipster cred if people want to drink your beer?
Well, it's
a funny psychology, but you're absolutely right.
It is a weird thing where it's just like, no, you don't understand. This is insufferable. You have to taste it.
Well, but there's a lot of beer
that's Malort in the cocktail world.
Well, you're talking to a Malort fan.
I love it too.
Not me.
Matt will give me hell about my appreciation for Malort.
We did a whole video for On Milwaukee of like everyone on staff doing a shot of Malort.
We did sort of a Malort face.
Ooh, was it on video so you can capture the face?
Absolutely. Yeah. But then Lori wrecked it because Lori like took a shot of it and was like, I quite like that. Oh, well, interesting flavors. How enjoyable. And it was just like, that is not the premise of this video, Lori.
Get on board.
This is not why we're here to enjoy the Malort face, though. That's true. I'm sure if you go on YouTube, you can find plenty of them.
A little bit of method acting, you can get there.
Do my best Daniel Day-Lewis and really commit to the bit.
Just imagine you stepped on a Lego.
That's the key to the key to the Malort face is the actual physical pain.
It's true.
Yes, for sure.
I actually did an event not too long ago and I got Malorted at a bar.
You know,
having done a good tour of duty in Wisconsin, I was not scared away.
I am thrilled by the verbication of Malort there. I think we need to,
you can be Malorted.
Yeah, we can be Malorted. I'm going to start using that more in articles.
Sort of like being molested, but less fun.
Malorted, yes. Yeah.
I'm going to start using that phrase.
Being Malorted.
I'm just going to use that phrase in the article for having nothing to do with alcohol. I'm just going to be like, the Packers got malorted last Sunday. Just an absolutely malortful performance from the Green Bay Packers.
It's like a loss that is also exceedingly bitter.
Exactly.
Only if they play the Bears.
Right. And only Lori likes it.
Well, if they play the Bears, then Malort's super apropos.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Hilarious.
So you were inspired definitely by your travels with Booze Cruise. I'm gonna pull us off this Malort.
Yeah. End it.
But did you know that this book was coming in the back of your head? So did you
actually
collecting recipes, or did you have to look back in your your list of experiences and go, what did I eat while I was?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So one was I had been advocating for this book for a long time, but mainly a general cookbook that would be bar food, and I didn't know what it was going to look like. So I never necessarily know what my books are going to look like. I pitch stuff, but then, you know, they get sort of turned around or changed, or editors want something different.
Exactly.
So, but in the back of my mind, I had a bunch of these recipes that I had sort of developed over the years, and doing Booze Cruise. No, I actually had no idea that something was coming. Normally, I sign a book deal, and in the back of my mind, because it's sort of freelance life and it's very difficult out there, I'm like, this could be my last book. I sort of think that, honestly, every single book. And then, you know, sometimes I have a few in the pipeline, so I know that it's not. But certainly doing Booze Cruise, I had no idea that I was going to be able to do a food book, and I was definitely advocating for it. So it's a combination of, you know, kind of going back after the fact a little bit. And, you know, I take pictures of everything I eat, mainly because my memory is bad. So I can kind of go back and look and see. And I take pictures of menus, and that's just sort of a habit. And then every once in a while, that habit really pays off because you're like, oh, I can go back through this trip around the world. And I mean, for example, the lime leaf peanuts in this book are a ripoff of peanuts that I had when I landed in Bangkok. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. And they're simple to make. And turns out that I got pretty close and I could call a couple people and, you know, that kind of thing is kind of get my, you know, work my way towards the Thai peanut that I tasted. And kind of come up with a recipe. So there's stuff like that. But yeah, I didn't know. I mean, it was funny. I worked with behind the scenes with my agent for a long time because you kind of get typecast in books, you know. If you have a successful cocktail book, why would anyone ever want you to do something else? Because that's a risk, right? Mm-hmm, right? So I was like, no, please let me do food. I promise it'll do okay.
We'll tuck some booze
which
in
we'll
there
see.
Too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, because this book does, it's largely recipes, but it's globally inspired, like basically snacks, right?
Right. Yeah.
And it ranges
from small to large. You know,
small to larger things, and seafood to, you know, like peanuts. You know, really.
Yeah. Whole noodle dishes, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
There's a few desserts in here. But it also gives you kind of, at least for each section, a good solid cocktail. So if you are at a loss for what you want to serve with your food, there are also cocktails, you know, in here.
Yeah,
so you can actually build a party. I mean, you even have a listing. How kind of you.
Yeah, got some parties back there. I try to be very good to my reader. I'm like, I got you. You want to know what to put with what? I can anticipate the question. Here's some
you
ideas.
Want a menu. You know, you want a freehand this? Go nuts.
Exactly.
You need a menu because you need to have a summer party. You don't know what to do.
Yeah.
There's a summer tequila party
for me too,
you.
Because otherwise you got to search through the whole book. You're like, what do I recommend? You know,
what goes with what? Yeah.
So I had started writing the book, and I realized very early on that I wanted to put some drink recipes in there. One, I didn't want somebody else to go, I have to buy a whole other book, right? If they get this, they have something. Two, I didn't want to put boilerplate stuff in there because nobody needs another Manhattan recipe because we can all just Google that. So I needed to have it stuff. I chose stuff that's sort of in context, sort of interesting anecdotes, sort of something that cocktailers should know, like the Vesper and potted shrimp, that kind of pairing, which is Ian Fleming pairings for James Bond. It's just fun stuff to have in a cocktailer's food book. Because I tried to make this kind of a little bit of a food Bible for cocktailers, you know. If you're big into cocktails, this should be, you know, hopefully a book that you have on the shelf because it's got flavor pairings and sort of helps and all that. So I did put in about 30 food recipes in here. And then just to talk about the taxonomy quick, because that is interesting, because I have all of these cocktail food books. I mean, mostly they're cocktail books or appetizer books. There's very few, like, cocktail food books on the market. But let's say these appetizer books, they all divide the entire book between small and large and cold and hot.
Right.
We look back at that and, you know, they were all written for an age of having chafing dishes and probably servants.
And a table full of food.
Yeah. Like, and I was just like, hot and cold makes no sense. Large and small makes no sense. So I did this book just like a cookbook where I'm like, there's a veggie section, there's a fish section, there's a chicken section, because there just wasn't another cocktail food book that was had that taxonomy. And I felt pretty strongly that, you know, gosh, when I pull this book down, it does not help me to know whether I need to put this in a chafing dish eventually before service or not.
Right. Am I thinking hot food?
It's weird. Like, how do you look anything up, you know? It was like, I guess I'll choose four
colds
and four
hots. You
better
hope you have a
hots.
Really good index where you can just look things up by ingredient.
Yeah, exactly. And of course there's no index and no pictures either. You know, you know, the old books are like these like weird encyclopedia cards kind of thing. Anyway, so that's how I got to how kind of the layout of the book.
Yeah. So with entertaining being in an interesting place right now, like, you know, I think people either really love entertaining, or they're part of a new generation of people who kind of eschew it, you know. Yeah. It's sort of like fallen out of favor to, you know, to go and have like a cocktail party. Where do you see this book, and what do you hope that it inspires?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think the younger generation, I sort of say the younger generation is allergic to the word entertaining. And I think because it conjures up all these like massive things, all these, you know,
all this
it conjures
work.
Up either going to, like, yeah, all this work,
it,
yeah.
or
going
to Trader Joe's. Yeah, yeah, it conjures exactly. up our parents like running around the house, cooking too many things that people yep. won't eat all of.
Yeah, they're once a year swear fest.
And like the parents in the kitchen working on entertaining while like the guests are in a separate room.
Right.
And it's just like,
right.
Yeah, I think that's what's turned it into a dirty word. You know, it's that yep. feeling of like, oh, it's the holidays, but you know, you're never going to see your mom because she's going right. to be in the going to be in the kitchen cooking.
She's
the turkey
assembling canapes.
Yeah,
and secretly, your mom is like, see, now I don't have to do all that. I can just
right.
cook.
Yeah, I can just stay here.
It was like, yeah. you know, I can hide in the kitchen if I want.
Someone go yeah. entertain the guests. it's very true. And I definitely side on more of the side of not wanting to be formal and fussy like that.
Yeah.
And I think it comes a couple of different reasons. One is I agree all that kind of formal stuff is just stuffy and not that much fun. And two, yeah. if you're focused on your cocktails so much and doing a really great job on cocktails, you kind of want your food to take care of itself a little bit.
Right.
Or to much more extent. You know, you don't want to... I feel like the people that made all the 20, you know, fancy bland canapé items back in the day, they served two really not great cocktails, right? I mean, right. that was sort of the trick. Like, oh, we'll just pop a Prosecco and stick some orange juice in it and send it out, you know?
Right.
So or cranberry, you know, it'd be like, you know, you'd spend all of this money on food and it'd all be fancy. And then drinks were like some kind of cranberry sour. And you're yeah. like, okay, wow.
Right.
And so things have flipped a little bit where, oh, now we're going to have, you know, you could serve a really great old fashioned or juleps or whatever at your French 75s, or there's a number of like mm-hmm. drinks that have kind of come into the party canon, but, you know, serve those. And then something just less fussy, you know, something that's, you know, either sheet panned if it's warm or, you know, some kind of one pot meal. I don't have any specifically like one pot meals in this, but a lot of things in the book have that idea. You know, it's okay. You have 6 to 8 people over, focus on making really cool drinks. And then here's this meat dish that you can all just share and everyone will think it's awesome. Everyone will remember it, but it was really a matter of assembling and sticking either in the oven or on the grill.
And there's lots of things. I mean, and there's lots of like riffs on things that people use, you know, like I think there's a riff on a cheese ball.
Yes.
In here.
The beloved and, cheese you know, ball.
And like the shrimp cocktail idea. Is there a, yep. is it piri piri shrimp?
Yeah, piri piri. So it's just the idea that instead of bland, it's like all spicy now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is fun.
And still go with what you're drinking, you know.
Yeah, I had to put a cheese ball in there, you know, having been in Wisconsin so long. And also, they're really easy and fun. I mean, cheese is great with cocktails because if you're focusing on cocktails and let's say you've, you know, accidentally had people over or, you know, people just show up and you can whip them up a great cocktail. Yeah. Bringing just cheese out of the fridge, of course, is amazing. You know, sort yeah. of Mediterranean style, yes. just bring out a board yeah. of stuff. But the cheese ball is fun because it's sort of an update. And it's like a campy thing, you know, but everybody loves it, but they don't want to admit it. So putting like a modern version in.
Yeah. And cheese balls are also easy. I mean,
yeah.
it's like, okay, you just need to be able to mash stuff up.
Yeah.
Mash
they stuff hold together. In advance. I'm a huge yeah. fan of like, if you are going to have a cocktail party, the cocktails are enough work. So I have a lot of recipes in here that are doable the day before. And the cheese ball is a perfect example of yeah. probably being better the next day. So everything's yeah. had a chance to meld.
Absolutely. So were there any recipes in here that were in the process of, and once you figured them out, you just couldn't stop eating them?
Well,
I don't know. Like occasionally when I did sure. more recipe development, I would happen upon something and be like, crap, I just want to make this once a week for the rest of forever.
There are a few. Of course, because I do cocktail at home a fair amount, the bar nuts are exceedingly dangerous, and I have to get them out of the house. The cashews in this book, they're sort of these, like, spicy, like, slightly sweet and spicy carameled cashews, and they're just ridiculous. So I definitely have a problem in that regard. Some of the cheese things, too, and the dips are really fantastic. The white bean dip, it's hard not to eat all of it. It's just a fun kind of an update of a white bean dip that kind of tastes different in every bite. And then, of course, some of the cookies and coins. I'm a big fan of coins. So you basically make, you know, you do a roll of cookie, and then you can put it in the freezer and cut off as many as you need.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And that is just a great, and that's just from hosting parties. I am not
that's like,
going
that's
to do
like
drop
the
cookies.
That's the amazingly oldest.
Yeah,
all like, this trick. Yeah, the freezer cookies, refrigerator cookies, whatever they were called. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just not going to make cookies and drop them, you know, four rounds of a dozen while I'm trying to prepare for a party. But if I can just pull, you know, cheese coins or, you know, cookie roll up out of the deep freeze, we're already done. It just cut them and bake them. And they're great, too. Again, if you have that sort of like impromptu party. I have a few things in here. Like if you have these pickled things or this or that in the fridge, if people come over, you can always just have a little cocktail party. Okay. And I think, too, the fun thing is, you know, the first cocktail party on record is in 1917. And her idea, she had people over for 1 hour. And I love that because it's basically like, yeah, come over. I'll make you some amazing cocktails. You'll have some snacks. Now get out.
is that where the phrase happy hour originates from? That first hour long cocktail party?
That the happy hour, in my understanding, happy hour more comes from bars that used to offer food
promo. Yeah.
Yeah, and they had what they called free lunch, which was not served during lunch. It was kind of served any time of day. It was a little bit more like Spanish tapas, where if you ordered a cocktail, you got gratis, like, nibbles from the bar. And that was a big thing up until the Civil War, is my understanding. Oh. And then sort of, and kind of died out in the 1890s. There were still a couple spots in New York, even up until the 60s, that did kind of free food. And you know, it's kind of held on, you know, now we just have bar nuts, basically, right? That's, or peanuts. That kind of offering is sort of the last vestige of what used to have been happy hour or free lunch. Little sandwiches and stuff. But the cocktail hour, yeah.
I really thought I was onto something there. Yeah. I thought I had pulled off some impressive anthropology there. I've cracked it.
Off the cuff.
Most everything was thought up by bars to get patrons to drink more.
Of course.
Makes sense.
And speaking of that, I mean, you talk about how cocktails often take time, you know, as much time as a dessert. I'm putting both you and myself on the spot because in looking through, you give some tips in here on batching.
Yeah.
Is that true? Because that definitely takes some of the, I mean, this is
kind of batching.
The all around party book as far as I'm concerned, because it hits on so many different things from kind of themed menus, to, yay. I mean, I think
hashtag
you could just
party
open
Bible.
To a page. Yeah. But if I recall, there is something about batching, which is another thing that takes some of the time away, at least displaces it, sort of like doing the cheese ball ahead.
Yeah, batching is fantastic. Batching and then also recipe cards are amazing. I really do feel that, like, as a cocktail party host or hostess, your job is not to make people's drinks all through the night. Your job might be to hand people their first drink and then leave a recipe card, let people knock themselves out, make their own. Batching really quick, the easiest one for people that are, you know, maybe have already had a few drinks, is the easiest thing to remember is that you can convert any ounces to cups in any recipe. So if a drink calls for 1 ounce of gin, one cup, you know, we'll make it for eight people. And you can just kind of
make sure to convert all the ounces to cups.
Yes, exactly. Really. Convert all the ounces correctly. Yes. That'll be enough math if you've already had a few drinks.
Right.
So that's one easy way to do it on the fly. But you can use any sort of math. You know, in advance, you can use any sort of math. And then the one caveat is all drinks are great to batch, except bubbles and citrus. You know, you want to add both bubbles and citrus at the last possible moment. But some drinks, like Negroni, stirred drinks, tend to be amazing batched and maybe preferable batched. So stir your Manhattan in advance, your martini, your Negronis. Those kind of cocktails are fantastic a day in advance. And they'll actually taste more blended and just somehow better and richer in the next day. Like,
because their molecules like knit together in this really fantastic way. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Cool. So... I mentioned this a little before, this idea of the taboos of pairing cocktails with food,
right?
And how they've all but been abolished. But people should still, I mean, there still are, like, I hate calling them rules because it's sort of like wine pairings, you know what I mean? In the end, drink what you like. You'll know if it tastes nasty.
Right. Although sometimes people don't. It always surprises me at people who love those big oaky cabs and they'll just drink that with fish because that's what they drink. They'll drink it with fish. They'll drink it with, you know, cheeses that don't work. They'll drink it with all this stuff. So there is a little bit of that, you know, like fish is one to watch out for probably. Your whiskeys don't work great unless you do, like, you know, pecan encrusted walleye. It's going to be great with whiskey. So there aren't that many rules. I do definitely point people to what I like to call flavor bridges. You know, so if your cocktail has rosemary in it, chances are it's going to be great with, like, lamb with rosemary. Almost to the exclusion of what's in it, in a way. If there's, you know, mint juleps are great with, you know, Mediterranean food because of the mint in there. So there's some stuff like that that's worth keeping in mind. I mean,
kind of the same with same tends to work with cocktails.
Same with same, not blowing away delicate things in either direction. Alcohol loves fats, so super fatty things. Some of this we already know because, like, you know, the blue cheese stuffed olives and martini, why does it work? Well, it gives a blast of umami, and it just, the alcohol loves those fats. And that's the same with wine. So it's not as easy as a 101, but I do like to say to people, you know, imagine a wine menu running from lightest Sauvignon Blanc or whatever down through cabs at the bottom. You can kind of do that with cocktails too. And these days, a good craft cocktail menu at a restaurant often runs that way from lightest to heaviest. So you'll find your bubbly sort of French 75 lemony drink at the top. And then at your bottom, you'll have some sort of oaked, you know, whiskey drink down there, or your Negronis down there, wherever you put bitters. But things kind of run that the same way, and you can kind of run your food similar to that. It doesn't always work, but it's helpful to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything you would have done differently? I asked this of
in this
all
book,
the time because finishing a book is one of those things where you're like, oh, good, it's done, right? And then, like, I don't know, by the time it comes out, then you're like, ah, maybe I should have done that.
I will say this right, I could never write a book. I just, the idea of something like that being set in page stone.
I
just know, like, I would open up to page one and immediately see a typo and be like, well, I'm going to go walk into the ocean.
You
now.
I'm going to go run in front
of a train.
It's so funny you say that, because for sure the weeks after the book comes out, I sort of, like, eyes pop open in the middle of the night, like, did I do this right on page 34? Did I end up seeing that and fixing it? That kind of thing. And also, tour is fun. You know, I'm on a big national tour, and it's fun to have restaurants and bars, you know, make the drinks from the book. But I always, you know, they'll hand me a drink from the book and I'll just look at the bartender and be like, was it good? Did you have to change anything? You know what I mean? I'm just, like, super honest about it, you know?
Well, that's going to be the best kind of book tour, because it's a book tour with food and alcohol. And I have to imagine, you know, it can be hard sometimes, I imagine, to get people to, like, a book tour where it's just a book and a reading and stuff like that. But if you're giving people food, if beverage is involved, then it's a night out of it, you know?
For sure. I am lucky. It's lucky and unlucky in a way, because I feel like cocktail people don't necessarily... They're not going to bookstores to look at cocktail books. They often know what they want. And I also feel like the cocktail section is sort of the redheaded stepchild of the bookstore in a way, because cookbooks are so popular. And then cocktail books are like, oh, they're on some shelf up above or kind of on a shelf nearby. But, that's alcohol. That's, like, the danger part. It's like, you know... It's like we're over with the sexy photograph books. Like, oh, those are cocktails. But it's true. I do joke, you know, I have friends that write about other stuff. Like, you know, I'm not writing about the Civil War, right? So when I go to a bookstore, people are like ready to have a good time. Exactly. So that's fun. And it has been fun. And also in the recent years, when I first started doing this in 2016, bookstores were bookstores and restaurants were restaurants. And since then, there have been a number of restaurants and or bookstores across the country opening up that have little bars in them. And a lot of them have liquor licenses now, which I think is so fantastic because just being able to go and browse any books with a glass of wine or a cocktail is amazing. So I've gotten really lucky in that going across the country, I've had the opportunity to have some of, you know, because there's nothing worse than talking about cocktails for an hour and then nobody can have one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. No, that's totally true.
It's a wonder why food television has succeeded the way it has, because it is like really, truly just like guilting people and just like,
for sure.
Look at all this food. Yeah. You can't smell it. You can't eat it.
Yep,
you look at it.
That's interesting to bring up. I do think there's something about food where when you like bite into a juicy burger on TV, we all sort of have this like, oh, I know what that's like. But yeah. I do think that one of the reasons there isn't that much booze TV, I mean, there's a cocktail competition show on now finally, but the reason I think there isn't is because stuff either just looks like clear liquid or brown liquid, and we don't have any like, you know, sort of reptilian deep associations with what that's going to taste like, the way that biting into a grape, we all kind of know.
Yeah, it doesn't have that like fatty, like what's the thing with like fat and salt that like your caveman brain activates.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Not quite that with that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a funny one for visuals.
How is that cocktail show, the cocktail competition show, as a cocktail expert?
I've been on the road, so I've only watched like one of them. It's really fun. They've done a great job with, you know, just what I said, that you can't really taste or these things. There's a lot of process in it, and there's a lot of garnish in it.
Okay.
So instead of just making it like a competition on what it tastes like, it's a competition on also the showmanship of it, and also having to make the processed ingredients that are going into it. So they figured that out. They figured it out, that it's like cool to watch the process.
What will intrigue people, and that's kind of the cooking part. Yeah.
Exactly. It is the cooking part. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is a cooking show. It just happens to be liquid. It's true.
Right.
All comes back to the food.
All comes back.
Liquid cooking.
To the foods and the flavors.
That's my next book, Liquid Cooking.
Listen, when I said it, my brain was
what is your next book. Yeah.
Your
next book is, though.
Yep, the next book is it's the 25th anniversary of The Big Lebowski next year. So I did the Big Lebowski cocktail book. Super fun project, super joyful, hilarious book.
That's a genius idea.
I can only imagine. But I'm thinking in my head, like, how in the heck did you think of a whole freaking book?
So all the characters and locations, you know, there's a drink for Jackie Treehorn, and there's a drink for Carl Hungus, and there's a drink for all, you know, there's a drink for all the characters and locations, and some of it, you know, the whole movie is sort of
15.
There's 50 some. Okay. It's fun. And there's a whole book of White Russians where I'm sort of like, here's a classic White Russian. Here's an elevated version. Here's a milk punch version, clarified version.
That's fun.
Yeah, there's a bunch of milk punches in there. And then a lot
of cocktails
hanging out,
that just sort of bring the room together.
Exactly.
Lori, you've done it.
I've already ordered those little rug mouse pads as my cocktail napkins.
Love it.
Excellent. This is all terrific.
We'll have to have you back to talk about
that. I'd love
to
be back. Yeah,
so we'll have to do that. But in the meantime, you are on a tour. And you will be in Milwaukee on November 22nd.
Yes, before Thanksgiving at Brian's Cocktail Lounge. Yeah.
And what does this look like for somebody who would like to go?
Yeah, for somebody who wants to go, Brian's is a wonderful, intimate space. I'm actually really excited for people that live in Milwaukee. It's important to know that Brian's is well-known everywhere. One, for an incredible sound system. Two, for having a whole fleet of those Hamilton Beach blenders, so you know he's pretty well known for ice cream drinks, which
for
is a Wisconsin thing,
which so many bars do not want to do.
No,
that's the iconic hate trick.
Yeah,
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the fact that he's still doing, they're still doing them there is amazing. A really pretty fun, intimate space. I think we're going to do some drinks from the book, and you know, I'll be chatting about the book and answering people's burning cocktail questions. Which this time of year, with the holidays coming up, people do have burning holiday cocktail
absolutely,
questions.
Absolutely, because now they're so entertaining. Yeah,
yeah,
and they might actually have a burning need for a bar menu book. That
they might have a burning need for the bar menu book.
And I
also, you know, remind people that, you know, just surviving your relatives is a lot during the holidays. So no better way to kick it off than learning how to make some drinks for yourself.
Totally true. Yes. If the day before Thanksgiving is the biggest drinking day of the year. Or among them.
Right.
You can go the day before.
Yeah, this is the day before that. So this is the pre-show to the horror show.
Yeah, absolutely. So, nice.
Yeah, really looking forward to being in Milwaukee. Actually, my first event in Milwaukee, shockingly enough. I've done Madison a couple times, but first time in Milwaukee. And it's a great town.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
It's a great drinking town. So I'm super excited to be there.
We're so good at it, we named our baseball team after it.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Yeah. It's a great cocktail town. So I'm super excited to be there.
That's well, true. In addition to Brian's Cocktail Lounge, where can people find you and your works just in general? Both the books and is there a social presence people should know about?
So I'm Andre, I'm just my name, Andre Darlington on everything, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. There's a website, andredarlington.com. You can get all my tour dates. There's links to all the books, all the press about the books. I do send out a newsletter, so there's a link to sign up to that. I don't destroy people's inboxes. It's like once a month, and you'll get some updates and then a recipe. So there's some fun ways to follow along. When the holidays come up, I sort of do a hotline. And, you know, if you have a burning question, hit me up on Instagram. Like, how much gin can you put in cranberry sauce? Turns out a lot. questions like that, I'm always happy to answer.
At what point does it just become a cranberry drink at that point?
I know, right? Well, that's for everyone
to
decide.
That's the point.
What is the line between a sauce and a cocktail? We will find out.
Find out on my website.
or how to get sauced.
How to get sauce.
Maybe that's where that phrase comes from. Yeah.
Here we go.
I'm going to dig up some...
jazz up your holidays with
the phrase sauced in terms of alcoholism was coined when someone put too much gin into the cranberry sauce and they got literally sauced.
I love it.
I think we've done it. I think I've done my anthropology for the day.
You got it in. Got it under the wire.
The happy hour didn't work out for me, but this one I think is going to stick.
Yeah, that's done.
Yeah.
Well, so, awesome.
Well, thank you for spending an hour with us.
Thank you guys so much for having me on. It's really a blast.
A truly intoxicating conversation.
Oh, I love it.
I've done it now.
Yeah. Totally.
No, really wonderful talking to you guys. Thank you so much. I hope to see you in Milwaukee one of these times.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hope to see you on the 22nd.
Yeah, now that I've started coming there, and I'm going to have to make it a thing. So.
Yes.
Sounds great.
Correct.
All right. Cool.
Let's call it a podcast.
Yeehaw.
An awesome conversation, as I joked, an intoxicating conversation. And indeed. Fittingly, we have a intoxicating kind of food porn here as well. Mm-hmm. Drink porn?
Drink porn? Yeah. Cocktail porn. yes. So for today's food porn, we have a piece called A Brief History of the Cocktail by Paula Bohin. Paula Bohinci. Oh, geez. I'm tearing this name apart. Apologies to Paula. Nonetheless, it is a lovely piece of writing that might actually hint at cocktails here and there.
Well, perfect. Well, Lori, I think I'm going to let you have at it.
Here we go. A Brief History of the Cocktail. Yes, of forsythia against the limitless ivy, a nude posed in a garden against the silver maple, pinwheeling its children into a gown around her. chime of the cliff-hanging falcon's screeching talons against a rabbit, wheezing soldier in a field, gunpowder tainting the cake in his pocket. Jet fuel over the Pacific, waking to a hula in a zephyr, the bride deplaning onto an island chain, bowing to the lee of Plumeria. The mallow of nurses' shoes, their news, the black sedan of a telephone spreading it like a virus, and after, the scent of a cedar closet. White gloves of a mare in heat, pawing clover, the sail of a Spitfire cresting a hill in San Francisco, angelic against sunlight, sunset. Rosen on a cello's catgut, a honeycombed queen calling home her lovers, a Basquiat above the head of an ascetic, chaos over order. Magenta in the thorns, shy to the shears, making the blue jays bluer, a someone on the bed's chenille edge, composing an oratorio of medicines. The bartender, in his ice pick scars, twisting zest over his creation, wheel and butane of his Zippo kissing as the citrus at last expresses.
Well, then, I'm glad you took that one on, because there were a lot of words that I do not
understand.
A lot
of words. Just in general, a lot of words. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's sort of got me, even though I had read it once.
Yeah, and as one who's looking at it right now, the punctuation is unfriendly.
Unfriendly to reading. Yes, definitely. Yes. As some poems are, but some pretty and then not so pretty images in there. But interestingly, that I think that's one of those where you need to read it like three times and you're like, oh, I sort of get it. in terms of how it follows the history of the cocktail, so to speak. So no, but great conversation today.
Indeed, absolutely.
Andre is a good one.
He's very enthusiastic, which is awesome. You love a guest that seems thrilled about everything.
And definitely passionate about what he does, and really absolutely good at what he does.
Absolutely.
A long while now. So,
And hopefully,
people are thinking about Christmas gifts, I don't know. I mean,
wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Or like, just a gift to yourself. You know, if you're planning a party, it's definitely, I have a copy of the book here, and it is full of delicious sounding recipes and just enough cocktails to kind of give you what you need to plan a party.
So, yeah. Well, hopefully think we do a good job at what we do, too. And if you do think that, where can people find our podcast, Lori?
Our podcast, yeah. Well, you found this podcast for yourself, but you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Food Crush Pod.
And you, Lori, where can people find you on them interwebs?
And you can find me at Lo Frederick in all of the same places. Catch me talking about food, sometimes cocktails. So how about yourself, Matt?
You can find me at A Man About Film on the slowly sinking ship that we call Twitter, as well as on Facebook and allegedly Instagram, but my once a year post.
Elon Musk does.
None of it. Following pattern recognition, not good. Yes, follow along. And thank you to our producer, Gabe. Thank you to our wonderful guest. And as always, thank you to you, our wonderful listeners. And as always, keep cooking and drinking.
And happy and then Thanksgiving.
Cooking. And happy Thanksgiving. Yeah. happy thanksin'.
Keep thanksin'. And cocktailing. And all those things.